dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to celebrate the passing of 2013, and what a year it has been. It's been a year long, and in most ways unremarkable.
And also 1942, apparently, which is a bit of a surprise.
Joining me today to talk about the best films of 1942 is Drew Tavendale.
Good evening.
And I, of course, am Scott Morris. So we thought we'd have a chat about some of the best and worst films of 2013, because, well, that's what we normally do about this sort of time, and, well, we don't like change, do we?
Oh, it frightens us.
It frightens us and confuses us. So we are just going to sit and talk about, well, let's start off with what we thought was some of the best films to appear in cinemas this year. Drew, would you care to pick one from your no-doubt frothing list?
Yes, I'm not going to start anywhere in particular. It just happens to be the one my eyes have alighted upon, and that's Steven Spielberg's excellent Lincoln, which I caught up with latterly, and it's off a good like. It's a really interesting period in both American and, for reasons outside of it, world history. A superb performance from the very reluctant to apparently appear in films at any point, Daniel Day-Lewis, but again, when he does appear, he's awesome. And surprising turn from Tommy Lee Jones, not really playing Tommy Lee Jones for once, and one of the best performances I've ever seen him in, despite the terrible, terrible wig. Well, what to say about it? And if you've not seen it, what's wrong with you? If you have seen it, watch it again, because it's really good. Stop listening to me, because I partly can't say anything useful about it.
Yeah, if I was going to pick one best film of the year, I would go with Lincoln. I think it seems to have fallen off a lot of people's best films of this year lists in the UK, because it came out in 2012 in America, and I think people have been wrongly assuming that we live in America, but we don't. We live in here.
They've been following the stupid BAFTA rules.
Yes, which is not correct in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah, a clutch of terrific performances and surprisingly engaging for something that could quite easily have been quite dry.
Yeah,
at the end of the day, about parliamentary procedure.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, it is politicking for the most part. It's the war going on is only ever in the background. There's some sort of family drama going on. But at the most point, it's a politician having to schmooze and intimidate or persuade or deal with various people in order to get a law passed. And that should be the driest of dry things, as you say. But remarkably, it's absolutely and utterly compelling. And again, Daniel Day-Lewis, I could just watch him endlessly.
And then you do, through a series of webcams and private surveillance in your special van. Oops, I've rather given the game away. What did I like this year then? I would perhaps go from this list with The Way, Way Back, which is something of a surprise. I thought I might like it because it had Sam Rockwell in it, but I didn't think I would like it quite so much. In rough summary, it's a kind of coming-of-age drama where a young boy tries to find his way in the world with his sort of stepfather giving him a hard time and so on and so forth, and he finds an escape in a water park run by Sam Rockwell and a crew of misfits, and it is just a surprisingly charming and very, very funny film. Certainly the funniest non-out-and-out comedy I've seen this year. It kept me laughing all the way through, and it has a number of surprisingly adept performances, particularly from the young lead, and also great performances from Sam Rockwell and the rest of the cast, Steve Carell in particular, given a great turn as a jackass. So, yes, heartily recommend that anyone go see that if they can. Anything else take your fancy this year, Drew?
Well, I noticed in putting together a list of the stuff I'd really enjoyed this year, there were a couple that, while the film wasn't perhaps the absolute tip-top, there was a central performance that was so compelling that made it more than worthwhile and would make it some of our most enjoyable films of the year. The first one I'd like to talk about is Behind the Candelabra, which was, due to a combination of bigotry, fear, and a bunch of other rather unsavoury traits, not released cinematically in the United States, but it was released cinematically here. It's about your fella with the blue rinse. What's his bloody name?
Liberace. Fibonacci.
It's a maths-based film, really. And there's this man, he gets some numbers and puts them in a sequence. It's riveting stuff. So Liberace. I mean, it's really quite interesting. It's about this, you know, the legendary showman, great performer, even if he wasn't the best musician, beloved of legions of women, and somehow nobody at the time realised he was gay, which always struck me as odd. But because of the time we lived in, and because of the unfortunately still prevailing bigotry, which is why he wasn't released cinematically in the United States, he was forced to hide his sexuality. And this was the story of his relationship with what could probably be described as the love of his life. And while the film doesn't get into as much of the character as you would like. As I was saying about the central performance, it could so easily just be caricature or impersonation, but Michael Douglas is astonishing in this. He just absolutely inhabits the role, and it's a very, very compelling piece indeed. It's possibly the best thing I've ever seen Michael Douglas. I mean, when you see him in stuff like Wall Street, he's clearly having a hoot, and that's a very entertaining film, but it's quite an over-the-top character, Gordon Gekko, and while Liberace, you think of over-the-top, there's a lot more to the character here, and never been Michael Douglas's biggest fan, but in this, he's just stupendous.
Certainly the most horrifying scene is in cinema this year is where you see him without his wig on, which was scared the livestock.
I don't know, that's quite bad, though. Yeah, one more thing for... You just give your thoughts on it, Scott. It was remiss of me to neglect to mention, too, when you mentioned scary things in the film. Rob Lowe in Behind the Candelabra. Oh, dear. I can't stop looking at pictures of Rob Lowe in this, and a sort of, you know, looking at a car crash sort of thing. They're horrendous and disturbing and yet really compelling. with his terrible, terrible wig and his bronzed skin and all the plastic surgery. his movement limited to a very slight incline of the head to agree with somebody because nothing else on his face works.
Yes, roundly terrifying. But I know not much else to add to that, but it is a number of very good performances, particularly Michael Douglas and Matt Damon as the central performances are great. And also it's good to see Scott Bakula around in a supporting role. Well, this does look to be sort of Steven Soderbergh's last film for a while, at least, going by what he's saying, if possibly forever. Then it was a hell of a note to go out on. Fair play to the man. I think featuring fairly high up my list would be Prisoners, a relatively recent film with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal and Paul Bucumdano taking the lead roles. A harrowing tale, for the most part, as Hugh Jackman's child is missing, presumably taken, and they suspect Paul Dano of the role, but the police can't get anywhere. So Hugh Jackman, once Paul Dano's released, sort of kidnaps him and essentially tortures him to try and get the information about what's happened to his daughter out of him. And it is a riveting film. It is deeply uncomfortable watching. It is not entertaining in the traditional sense. It asks a lot of fairly pointed questions about what you might do in this situation and how your own drives to protect your family might kick in. Aside from all that, it does have a very strong central kind of whodunit storyline with some great performances, and it is certainly worth looking at. I enjoyed that wholeheartedly. It's probably the best serious drama, if you will, that I've seen this year. One thing I would say, looking through this list, is almost all of the films actually that I'm looking at are fairly lighthearted in nature, and this is probably the darkest one that I have in the list, and it is all the stronger for it. Very impactful, really good performances throughout, and maybe a little bit too long, but I think it did, for the most part, hold attention very well throughout, and I think very worthy of a recommendation.
Yeah, that's another one that I'll need to catch up on. I'm going to stick with my theme here of the central performance being the really compelling aspect, even if the rest of the film's perhaps not quite as good as I would have hoped. And this time I'm going to talk about Flight, which is, well, it's Denzel Washington. He's a bit good, isn't he? Frankly, he's a bastard because he's just great in more or less anything he's ever in. Even more so when he can really get his teeth into something, and this is absolutely that. It's nice seeing Robert Zemeckis back doing some live-action stuff as well, but the compelling thing here is Denzel Washington. The ending's a bit too Hollywood, perhaps, and some of the other characters could do with a bit of fleshing out, and it has a really, 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 really terrible name. Not least because it has absolutely nothing to do with the film at all, really, because it's just the catalyst for him to confront his alcoholism, and it could have been anything.
Yeah, it should have been called Crash or Drunk.
Or medical negligence lawsuit. I mean, he could have been anything. He didn't have to be a pilot. Although, as perhaps beyond this, that the fact he had the ability to save these people is what helps him be in denial for just that bit longer. But it's Washington again. He's one of those people that tends to rise above the material, but he has given really good material here, and he's just utterly compelling to watch.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Very good film. Yes, it's hinged on Denzel's performance of a character that is in many ways not likable in the slightest.
Oh, no, yet he is somehow a complete asshat.
Yeah, but yet somehow sort of is likable regardless of that. Perhaps it means it works better than it should, but yes, very good film. Enjoyed that an awful lot. If you did want to criticise Flight as being too Hollywood, then I suppose a suitable antidote would be Filth, the adaptation of the Irvin Welsh novel, which is about as far away from Hollywood as you can get. An Edinburgh cop gone bad. Very bad. very, very bad, as James McAvoy takes the role of Bruce Robertson as he lies, cheats, takes drugs, and does all sorts of things that really policemen shouldn't be doing. It is a masterclass of just enthusiasm, I think, more than anything else. You can certainly level a number of accusations of it, particularly it being kind of patchy. The central plot doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it is just told with such enthusiasm and sheer verve and guts that it's difficult not to enjoy it. I don't know how well it travels outside of Edinburgh, let alone UK or the world, but I enjoyed it wholeheartedly. A terrific, just roller coaster ride of a film, and the sort of, I suppose, roughly central relationship between James McAvoy and Eddie Marsden is just a joy to behold. Lots of nice little character touches, even if the characters themselves are not nice. Definitely worth taking a look at. Mental, but really good.
Yeah, Filth is one of my favourites of the year too. It's horrendously inappropriate. It's deeply, deeply funny, filthy, evil, rude, nasty, but just wonderful. And I was going to mention this in context of the difference that happens when you get the real actor in. Now, one of the poorer films I saw this year, though by no means the worst, was Welcome to the Bunch, which had James McAvoy and fake Eddie Marsden, and it was pretty underwhelming. Whereas Filth has James McAvoy and real Eddie Marsden, and it's fantastic. And I think the scene of Eddie Marsden and Filth in the nightclub in Hamburg off his tits on Eckies is probably a top contender for scene of the year. I could just watch that endlessly. I share Scott's reservations that, or your reservations, Scott, I'm talking to you and there's no one else here. But I do share your reservations about it possibly not travelling well. Mm. But if you can get through the accents, if you're not Scott, it's just a hoot. And I use that word an awful lot, I know, and I blame entirely a sketch from Kids in the Hall for it. It's a hoot is what it is, but it's just really, really fun. And you will probably feel very bad for with yourself for laughing at almost all of it, actually. You'll laugh so much you probably won't care, and nor should you. Okay, another of my favourites of the year, and it's the last of my triumvirate of films where, well, the rest of the film's very good, perhaps not magnificent, but the central performances alone are really worth a watch, and that's Ron Howard's Rush, the story of the rivalry between James Hunt and Niki Lauda in 1970s Formula One. Looking back on it, I think it's still probably the best or equal best sporting biopic I've ever seen. It's one of Ron Howard's best films. He shies away from the schmaltz and sentimentality he normally bathes in. And it's fantastically well produced. It looks great. It looks like a period piece. Some superb stunt driving, actual physical effects work, and a very compelling tale that doesn't do the same thing that so many sporting biopics do, of just like having a hero and a villain. Both characters here can be absolute wankers, but both are also appealing, compelling, and really quite well-rounded characters. They're both dedicated professionals, both have foibles, but they both have many things to their credit as well. And it's, if you've got any interest in Formula One, you must see it. If you've got any interest in sporting biopics, I think you'd be doing yourself a disservice not to. And if you just like good filmmaking, then you should probably catch it as well.
Absolutely. I don't really give the first hoot about Formula One or any people in it, but this was a great film to watch and just a great drama between two strong characters. Notable, I think, for a couple of things. First, it's hard to believe that it's about, 10 years since Goodbye Lenin, where I first really heard of Daniel Brühl,
yeah.
But who I think does absolutely tremendously as Niki Lauda. It's a great performance, perhaps my favourite performance of the year, on a character one.
I'm not sure I could pull one out again. You've got Daniel Day-Lewis's Lincoln and mm-hmm. Michael Douglas's Liberace, but it's right up there, and assuming you have enough time, you don't need to pick one, watch them all. Yes. They're all extremely good. Yeah, Daniel Brühl's particularly good in this.
And I think Chris Hemsworth as well. Yeah. Who knew he was so good?
And certainly we talked a few podcasts back about the second Thor film as well, and his charisma really helps here, whereas it wasn't so much in evidence in the original Thor. Came through a bit more in The Avengers. Mm-hmm. But now you see, this is the finest performance by far I've seen Chris Hemsworth in, and really, the man's got some acting chops.
He surely does.
And quite a bit of charisma too, so it's all good, really.
There was a number of big budgety tentpole things, films this year that were largely as good as each other and probably didn't stand out much you know, in comparison to each other, but there was one that I think was head and shoulders above everything else, and that's Iron Man 3.
I would say was the one I would say was head and shoulders above the rest.
I'm not sure Craig agrees, but he's been wrong about lots of things in the past, and he's wrong in this one too, if I'm not giving him the wrong idea. But yeah, Iron Man 3 is, I think, easily the best Iron Man film. Shane Black gives it a welcome shot in the arm that gives the formula a bit of a mixing up. Sure, it's got its issues. Probably the start is the weakest of maybe all the films, but by the end of it, gosh, doesn't it just pick up some great misdirection with the lead characters, some really innovative action scenes.
Mm-hmm.
It suffers, as with all stuff these days, from being your CG things knocking hell out of other CG things, but at least this has put a bit more thought into how it works out.
Yeah, they put a lot of thought into trying to get Tony Stark, his face in the form of Robert Downey Jr. on screen as much as possible without being clad in a silly suit or being a CGI replacement. And when that wasn't the case, they basically tried to think of every inventive thing they could do with the Iron Man suits, which means it wasn't just like the normal, here's a big strong thing knocking seven bells out of another big strong thing.
Easily the most innovative action film of the year. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what more can you say about Robert Downey Jr.? What a guy. Another tremendous performance. I don't see what you can do with Iron Man after this point, which is, I think, both a good thing and a bad thing. This seems like it would be a very fitting end to the Iron Man films, but I know they're going to keep on making them and the Avengers films and whatnot, but it just feels like I'm not sure where they're going to do from this, where they could take it that's going to be any better than this. But that's an issue for another day, and I think that Iron Man 3 is, of the big budget things I've seen this year, easily the best.
And the second Iron Man was a real disappointment, and after seeing, for instance, how not at all happy to be there in a contractual obligation sort of way Robert Downey Jr. was in the stinger after the credits of The Incredible Hulk, I was thinking he'd lost faith in the series already, but then you have the Avengers in this, and it's like, yep, this is pretty damn good, and Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. is a combination I very much approve of. So I look forward to seeing them again, but perhaps not as with Iron Man this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll go from a big budget action to comedy for me now. And I'm going to mention two films here because they both had, well, similar settings-ish and such similar names that I got confused about which one I was seeing the first time round. And that's This Is the End and The World's End. So we'll take This Is the End first and Scott maybe speak about The World's End. It's a post-apocalyptic, filthy, inappropriate, dirty comedy, and I loved it. It's Jay Baruchel goes to visit Seth Rogen in Los Angeles. They go to party at James Franco's house. The world ends. Probably a typical Friday night for many of you, but this is an actual ending of the world. You know, people being taken into rapture, the earth splitting asunder, huge beasties roaming about, Emma Watson, one of these is unlike the others. And it's one of the few films that I've seen then that I think I laughed almost constantly from beginning to end. I can see why some people wouldn't like it. It's one of those films, there's so many almost like in jokes, and they've basically tried to find everybody they've ever worked with and get them a cameo role.
Yeah.
And it could so easily have gone wrong and been horrendously self-indulgent, but I was pissing myself laughing for the entire running time.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm having a memory failure, but of the relatively big budget effects heavy kind of comedy things that have been done in the past, yeah, I can't think of too many that have worked. Certainly anything like as good as This Is the End does. Just, again, probably just due to the charisma of the performances, I'm still not sick of Seth Rogen somehow. I'm not sure how that's happened.
I think The Green Hornet was a bit of a blip because he really was quite unlikable in that, and it was just a generally bad film. But every other film, he's still playing Seth Rogen and I'm still really liking him.
Yeah.
I haven't reached saturation point yet, and I'm quite surprised by that.
And that sort of double act with him and Jay Baruchel was sort of just charming, and just it worked very well. Also a bit of a turning point for me with Jonah Hill, who I've not really liked him in an awful lot of things, apart from this, where he's playing a very strange version of himself.
Yes.
And I thought he was amazingly funny in this too. Yes, a number of really good comic performances, funny effects stuff that actually works, and yeah, just genuinely very enjoyable. The other similarly themed comedy that we're talking of is, of course, The World's End from Edgar Wright, the Three Colors Cornetto trilogy. It doesn't really make sense, that Cornetto trilogy. I don't know where it's coming from, apart from the fact you've put in a Cornetto in every one of the films. That's just item placement. That's just marketing. But regardless, this follows to an extent the same formula, in as much as it's Simon Pegg and Nick Frost going around doing their double act, this time as part of five friends who are trying to recapture their lost youth by taking part in a pub crawl that didn't work out quite so well last time. Now, there's maybe, 20 to 30 minutes at the start of this film where it actually isn't any good. It's not necessarily bad, but it's not very funny. And I was about to give up on it at some point, and then very suddenly kicks into high gear and is, for 60-odd minutes, amazingly funny, with a number of very good effects stuff as well.
Absolutely.
At the same time, has managed to weave in a not entirely inconsequential drama in some performances, especially even from Nick Frost, who you don't normally associate with that kind of thing. Good supporting performances from Tim from The Office, as he's always credited, and Barry Constantine. It's just very funny and definitely worthy of your time.
Yeah, it's the beginning is a hard watch because Simon Pegg's character is so unlikable.
Yeah.
And he does such a good job of playing him very, very unlikably that it's a real hard watch, but it almost entirely pays off later on.
Yeah.
And it's just fantastic. I mean, I enjoyed it so much, it's very possibly going to challenge Hot Fuzz for me out of those three films.
Yeah. While we're on the general subject of comedy, can I just throw in a few more? Because there's five comedies here that I genuinely couldn't really pick one if I was going to go for whichever's funniest. It would probably depend on what mood you pick me in.
Okay.
But the other contenders would be the very recent Anchorman 2 with Will Ferrell. Terrifically funny. It's probably recent enough in everyone's memory. I don't think we need to go into too much detail about it, but it's the sequel to the Anchorman film sees Will Ferrell and his gang of miscreants revisit their seminal performances, and it's just deeply funny all the way throughout.
Well, not quite all the way through, which is the only bone I have to fight with that. It's unnecessarily long and becomes, and one of the main reasons it's so long is it does get a bit self-indulgent at times, which does a little undermine how funny it is for the rest of it. But other than that, it's really, really funny.
Yeah.
They've amped up the screen time of Steve Carell's Brick Tamland, and to the point where the film really couldn't take any more Brick Tamland.
Yeah.
But they've got just enough in there that it's hilarious. And if you like the first one, then it's something you have to see. If you like Will Ferrell at all or Steve Carell at all, I think you get a lot out of it. May I take a guess at what the next comedy you're going to mention is, Scott?
You can guess.
Does it involve Norfolk?
Yes. If I was going to pick one, I'll save that one for a minute. But if we can go back to Bad Grandpa with Jackass, and there is really nothing to say. It's a series of loosely connected road trip vignettes with Johnny Knoxville playing aging himself up to play the, 80-something-year-old Irvin Zeisman's, and taking his young grandson, Billy, across the states of America and getting into ridiculous scrapes in the sort of Jackass style of semi-scripted with genuine public reactions and stunts and so on, which is just very, very funny.
It's very, very crude, but it's unapologetically so. I would say it's not the sort of film that's for everyone, and it may be a mood-dependent one, but there's nothing wrong with lowbrow stuff as long as it's funny, and this is damn, damn funny.
Yeah, and as you say, returning to Norfolk, what I think would, if you'd twisted my arm and told me pick the funniest of these, of those five comedies that I've really enjoyed this year, I think Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, is probably the best that I've seen this year. It is a fitting summation and perhaps conclusion to the Alan Partridge character, which, despite seemingly like it should be a completely ridiculous over-the-top premise for a film with Alan Partridge being, with his radio station being taken hostage by a coal meanies just sacked disc jockey, which you would think was just too ridiculous and overblown for something as small scale as Alan Partridge, as he typically is. You would think that it's too big a concept to fit around the character, but somehow, despite the fact that it's a gunpoint siege, they're still just talking about doing silly radio links, talking about Banged Up Abroad and things like that. It somehow manages, despite itself and despite the situation it's in, to be unapologetically colloquial.
And surprising humour derived from unexpected contents of lunchboxes.
Exactly. Brilliant use of the language, brilliant use of some sort of comic framing and things like that, and a terrific performance from Steve Coogan. Probably not the only one, certainly, I would talk about this year, but given that he seems to have been so desperate to break away from the Alan Partridge character with his dramatic roles, it's strange that he manages to knock it out of the park so much in this. It's now difficult again to separate Steve Coogan from Alan Partridge. Great moments of Alan, as you will. Even for someone like me who's not the world's biggest Alan Partridge fan, this certainly would make me.
Yeah, I've never been an Alan Partridge fan at all, ever, and I was roaring throughout this. I wouldn't put it quite as high as This Is the End of the World's End of my funniest of the year. I think those do it for me, but it's not far behind. And I would say Steve Coogan's performance here is without doubt the best comic performance. Even though the film as a whole wasn't as good as some others, I think his performance as Alan Partridge is amazing.
Mm-hmm. So I think you should pick one, since I've rudely done the last three.
Right, one of the few films, but not by design, just by coincidence, that I've seen this year that hasn't been in the English language, Francois Ozon's In the House, which is about a rather cynical, world-weary teacher taking a quite staggeringly talented student under his wing, and then finding that he's got a rather odd obsession with one of his classmates' mothers and their family in general. There's an element of mystery in it, there's an element of exploration of narrative, which is very, very clever, and some of the best characters I've seen this year too. It's quite hard to explain, or at least I'm finding it quite hard to explain. I think it's something you'd need to see. It's one of the cleverest things I've seen in a while. It's really good, see it.
Yeah, very compelling film, In the House. Creepy, I think.
Oh yeah, it's certainly creepy, yeah.
But yeah, two strong central performances again, with very good support and a really interesting story, and the way it plays with storytelling and the story itself and its various little narrative tricks and pointing out these narrative tricks to you. It's a very brave film, because it could so easily have just vanished up its own jacksie. Yeah. But
it's quite meta. And yeah. Absolutely, yes. It could easily be described as pretentious and could very much have taken a right turn up its own arse. But it does
pulls
it with, it does it with such aplomb that it manages to sidestep that potential landmine.
Yes, very good. One of the few foreign language films that's bothering the top of my list this year. Actually, animation, it's from Up on Poppy Hill, from Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki, the younger Gorō Miyazaki's film. And while it seems a bit narratively hackneyed, certainly it's not redefining anything in the genre, and it's almost just taking things from the Studio Ghibli playbook. I just think that it does it so well, and there's just so many nice little touching moments of just small, intimate drama that you'd struggle to get in any number of live-action films, let alone animations. And there's a number of really great moments like that that really elevate the rest of it, which is, by itself, is pretty decent and actually very enjoyable. Although not narratively redefining anything, it is basically a love story between two young children who are also finding out things about their family and trying to save their school's clubhouse, which is by itself narratively no great shakes, but there's some lovely beats of emotion. It probably is the most touching film I've seen this year, and it connected with me on an emotional level that most other films haven't this year. Very deeply enjoyable film on that basis. Not Studio Ghibli's best, but given that Studio Ghibli's best is some of the best films ever made, that is no great shame, and I certainly enjoyed From Up on Poppy Hill very much, and look forward to seeing what the next thing that Gorō Miyazaki has got for us to watch and that with his films, what he does.
It wasn't quite as high in my list of films that, well, more or less a grouping, yes, of films that I really enjoyed this year, but yeah, still very much enjoyed it. It's just lovely. There's, as you say, some really deep emotional beats in there. But there's just the simple observation of domestic life is so beautifully drawn and so beautifully observed that you could just sit and watch the people eating breakfast for an hour. It's just it's so naturally and wonderfully done. And I rather suspect that's a hard sell to anybody listening. It's like, the people have breakfast and it's nice. It sounds like there's so little there, but emotionally and tonally, it's just such a lovely film. And it being a Studio Ghibli film, it looks bloody gorgeous too. Another of my favourite films of the year. Well, this is the whole point of this podcast. That was a redundant sentence. another one I'd like to talk about was from almost exactly a year ago now, and that's Django Unchained, which, to use my favourite word and talk about films that I like, apparently, was a hoot. Very tonally similar to Inglourious Basterds, but almost 300% more effective than that was, and a hell of a lot more fun too. Quentin Tarantino even manages to produce one of his own films and give himself a cameo role that isn't deeply objectionable and shit, which is quite a trick, because nobody thought he'd manage that before. It's a deeply historically accurate, of course, portrayal of the American South during the time of slavery, and I don't understand why people were getting their knickers in a twist about it, because it seems spot on. These people are, of course, idiots. It's a black slave revenge fantasy. It's over the top. It's gory, it's violent, it's Tarantino at his best. Everybody involved seems to be having a lot of fun and putting a really good performance. Christoph Waltz is, as you'd expect, fantastic. Jamie Foxx is great as Django. Leonardo DiCaprio is having a whale of a time as the evil Candy. And it's probably the only film ever that had a dentist bounty hunter, which sets apart all on its own. It's almost cartoonish. It's like sort of the kind of violence you might expect in something like Itchy and Scratchy almost. It's kind of that sort of level. And it's brilliant. Just in case you've only just heard what some people have said about it and haven't seen yourself, it's not meant to be taken seriously. People say it's not historically accurate. Nobody ever suggested it was meant to be. And these people seem to have just steered incredibly wide of the point.
Puzzlingly, it seemed to be the same people that were giving Inglourious Basterds a free pass. And it was not, to my recollection, historically accurate either. Or I believe good, there was actually a certain amount of liberties taken with that too.
No, I'm pretty sure there was a Jewish hit squad that killed Hitler. I think you need to check your history books there, Scott.
I'll go and read up on that. No, largely agree. Probably didn't enjoy it quite as much, but it's still good to see Quentin Tarantino at something approaching his best, because he's not been there for a while.
No.
It's good to see him return to that kind of promised land. Yeah, it's certainly very enjoyable.
It's not his absolute best. It's not Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, nor is Inglourious Basterds or any of the Grindhouse stuff. You know, it's like you remembered how to make an enjoyable film.
Yeah. I think probably the last film that I put on my list of, you know, really top-of-the-line films this year would be something I alluded to perhaps a little bit earlier. It's Philomena, the other Steve Coogan film in this list, where Steve Coogan plays Martin Sixsmith, the journalist who takes the story of the titular Philomena, played by Judi Dench, who had her kids taken from her by some evil nuns in an evil convent. I'm sure we're thinking they were doing things for the best, but it's a tale of her trying to find her son that was taken away from her decades prior. And it is, I suppose, at heart, a road movie, but with added infuriating historical perspective, which is at moments slightly poorly handled, at least in terms of how it's kind of telling you what you should be feeling at any particular moments through the lens of Martin Sixsmith's character taking some rants where, you know, I could pretty well judge the morality of it by myself without having been preached to by one of the central characters. However, regardless of that, it's a charming tale. As well as being infuriating, the interplay between Steve Coogan and Judi Dench is very well handled and very funny at points, at the same time as being very touching and a very powerful drama at the same time. So it does manage to take quite a lot of its cake and eat it, spilling only a few crumbs. So again, one of the more powerful films of the year and also enjoyable. So I would heartily recommend Philomena too.
I largely agree with what you say there, Scott. It's nice to see Steve Coogan doing a straight role and doing it very, very well. It does have its faults. It becomes preachy at times. It's just unnecessary. You think you can come to that conclusion quite easily on yourself, but the filmmakers said they'd need to stamp their own opinion on it. Rather than that, it's a very compelling film. Not a comedy, again. No. I don't understand why the people who market it as a comedy, where they're coming from. An asylum, presumably. It's a drama with some humour in it, not a comedy. No, it's kind of hard to sell The Catholic Church Stole My Children as a comedy. Maybe I'm the one that's been now-reminded here, but I just can't see that happening. So those are the films that we really consider absolute best of the year. There's plenty there to check out if you have, however, already checked those out or are hungry for more. We're certainly able to furnish you with a few more films that not the tip-top in terms of quality, but certainly interesting for various different reasons. And the first one I'd like to talk about is Compliance, which is an odd film in as much as that while I was watching it, I thought, this is ridiculous. This film has gone a bit over the top and to the point of, no, that's just stupid. How am I supposed to believe that? And you watch the film and you think this is getting sillier and sillier. You get to the end credits and then you also do a bit of Googling afterwards and you realise, right, this isn't so much a stupid film as a stupid, stupid society. And, oh crikey, this is real. If you don't know what that is, I'll just give you a quick recap. This is the story based on, as I mentioned there, a real story about a man who was phoning up fast food restaurants in the United States and having the managers detain, search, and in other ways abuse their staff members by pretending to be a police officer. And the worry thing, by the name of the film is Compliance, these people did it more or less unquestioningly.
Yeah,
as I say, it's hard while you're watching it to really enjoy it, but as soon as you get to the end, realise it's real, you realise, actually, yeah, okay, that was very good. The performances are very natural and really rather impressive. There's a real feeling of claustrophobia in it and persecution. And thing about this film, though, is that it does leave you wondering quite how, well, stupid people can be and how readily they'll do harmful things to their fellow human beings.
Yeah, it's puzzling to think that this is real. The film itself is arguably less interesting than the fact that it is real.
Yes, that's fair.
It's a very strange thing to think of when this is actually, from what I can tell, pretty accurately based on real events.
That's the shocking thing I found out afterwards. This can't be real. This can't be real. Oh, it's real. Oh, Craigie.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the more interesting watches. One of the things where perhaps just reading the story of what happened was, it might actually even perhaps be more impactful than the film, but it's certainly a very interesting way to spend 90 minutes or whatever it is. It's just such a weird story, and to think that it's actually true is just really, really baffling, but it's certainly all the better for it.
It's genuinely frightening to think that it's true.
One thing I'll say, just in general about 2013, whether I've just been fortunate or more discerning than usual, but I'd say in general the quality of the films I've seen this year is, I think, higher than most years, certainly the last five or so. Even the things that I put down here as being, you know, roughly mediocre still actually seem to be above what we would normally think of as mediocre in a year. So
I think the sort of the median quality seems to be higher. There are fewer absolute standouts, I think, but then there's fewer absolute clunkers too. And just a few nights ago I was thinking, I don't remember seeing any absolute stinkers this year.
Yeah.
But preparing for this podcast, I remembered a couple, but I apparently just blocked them. But yeah, the fewer standouts, but a higher overall average quality, I would say.
And one thing that I swithered about whether I put it into my best films of the year list, elevate this into something that's really good, because this is a sort of film that I really, really want to like, perhaps a bit more than the film actually deserved. But I think in terms of its scope and ambition, you can't let the year go past without talking about Cloud Atlas.
I swithered a bit whether to put that in mine as well, Scott, for exactly the same reasons. I admire its ambition.
Yeah, I am glad that they are still taking bets like this, and there is at least some evidence of that, you know, continuing in cinema. The Wachowskis have had mixed success since the original Matrix, but I mean, it's difficult to, when you first watch that Matrix, and it's difficult to remember now though exactly how impactful and how amazing that film was to watch it the first time, and they kind of went off the boil since then. But Cloud Atlas is the kind of film that by its very nature has to be strange and patchy and sort of points difficult to like, and just weird and complicated and difficult. But it's the sort of thing that really shouldn't be made, but they have made it, and I think for the most part, they made it work.
Made a pretty good fist of it, yeah. It's very much a film that I can understand why people simply wouldn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's narratively a mess. It's in danger of becoming quite Babel-like in the way it suggests that actions in one person's life impact on another, although this time it's lifetimes rather than within the same life with different people.
Yeah.
But it's the ambition that I admire. I like that something like this and so big budget got made.
Yeah.
It's a very rare thing. It's likely just to become rarer still. And it's definitely something worth watching. Even if you don't understand it, again, I can see why some people would sort of lose track of quite what's happening.
Yeah.
And the idea of constantly reusing the same actors does get bit tiring after a while, but it's very interesting. It's genuinely good filmmaking at some points, and the rest is like, you know, just isn't it better just, you know, reach for the stars and maybe fall short rather than just like, no, I can't be bothered with them at all.
Yeah.
Next one I'd like to mention quickly is Robot and Frank. It wasn't a perfect film. I felt that the world felt a little bit empty, possibly a product of a small budget, I'm not sure. But yeah, a really interesting premise. It's a cat burglar with dementia persuading a robot bot to help him pull off a heist. It's an odd one, I'll grant you that. But Frank Langella is fantastic in it. Peter Sarsgaard as the voice of the robot is really appealing too. It's damn funny. It's probably quite unlike most films you're going to see plot-wise, and it's really rather entertaining.
Yes, absolutely. I enjoyed that an awful lot. Another sort of science fiction-y thing of the year that I liked would be Elysium. Far from perfect, but this Neil Blomkamp follow-up to District 9 sort of follows in a way to kind of roughly similar sort of trajectory as Matt Damon tries to find a better life off-planet and save his life and that of others in a sci-fi spectacular. It's just about spectacular enough to get away with the fact that it's a bit weakly plotted in places, but very enjoyable. It is as a kind of popcorn fare, works very well, I thought. Not superb, but in the sort of grand scheme of things, it's a more kind of action-y, sillier science fiction thing, works pretty well.
Yeah, I don't like it as much as you did, but it's quite interesting. The plot is daft, but it's quite entertaining. It looks quite good. Jodie Foster's accent is utterly puzzling as well as terrible. But beyond that, and I've never quite understood the love for Charlotte Copley, but he makes a pretty good villain here.
Yeah. Better than a hero, I thought.
Certainly better than he was in District 9, and a world away from Murdoch and the A-Team. Yeah, if you like science fiction and a bit of Matt Damon, then you'd do worse than checking Elysium out. Right, another film I particularly enjoyed this year, and I know a lot of people didn't, but I did, which was Star Trek Into Darkness, follow-up to J.J. Abrams' reboot of Star Trek in 2009, a plot involving a sort of superhuman guy who's manipulating people left, right and centre, evil Robocop Admiral. But it's Star Trek. If you've probably seen it. If you haven't, you probably don't want to. There's probably no point talking about it, but I liked it. How's that for a pointless talk about a film? There we go. I've hit a new low. Well done, me.
It worked as well as it needed to. Probably no better than that, but I thought it was an enjoyable tentpole film. I don't think it's as good as the first Star Trek, rebooting.
Yes.
Which I think was surprisingly good. This one's just, you know, good enough to get by, but it's still by no means bad, and it's certainly much, much better than almost all of the previous generation Star Trek films.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, apart from probably First Contact and maybe the original Wrath of Khan, it's better than any Star Trek film.
Yeah.
One other thing I'd just quite like to say about it is one of the most interesting things that came out of Star Trek, it's nothing to do with the film at all, but hopefully not the beginning of a trend of film companies having found a new way to screw over consumers, in that it's nigh on impossible to get a copy of this with the director's commentary. If you want that, you have to buy it from iTunes, because it's an iTunes exclusive. So you get to watch, pay for it twice, or put up with shitty sound and picture quality. Yay, technology!
Yeah, I'm sure the internet offers ways to route around that, but not that we're advocating anything illegal, but I'm also not advocating you buy any movie from iTunes either. I suppose there's two other big-budget, sequel-y type things that we could put into roughly the same category as Star Trek Into Darkness, and they're both pretty good. The one that most strictly follows the formula would be The Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug, because it is roughly the same as the first one. And if you know what to expect from the first one, then you'll know what to expect from the follow-up. It has many things wrong with it, which we've discussed in podcast past, but even still, it is somewhat more enjoyable than the first one. So on that basis, if you like that, then you will like this. Perhaps a slight variation is Thor 2, which again was one of the big budget things that was high, but in this instance, slightly different, because the sequel is so much better than the first one that it's not funny. Similar kind of idea, you have the big Norse god / alien superhero knocking about, but it's just actually quite funnily written in places.
It doesn't achieve it as well as Iron Man 3 does, but it does when it comes to its big CGI on CGI thump fest at the end. It manages to be quite inventive. It tries to mix up a wee bit from how it's been in other Marvel films. Big step over the first one. In fact, it's been a rather good year for sequels in general. It could quite easily have just been an absolute mess. Sequels so often disappointing, but you've got a Star Trek sequel, which is pretty good. The Hobbit sequel, better than might be expected. Thor 2 sequel, far better than would be expected. Hunger Games 2, The Hungering, was quite enjoyable. Anchorman 2 was great. Iron Man 3 was great.
The Wolverine was probably better.
The Wolverine, the 842nd sequel in the X-Men series. Again, not without its flaws. It didn't explore the more interesting parts of it as much as it might have done with Wolverine losing his powers, but it's still a very enjoyable film. And yeah, it's been surprisingly good year for sequels. I'd still rather there were more original properties in there, but if you are going to have sequels, better that they're good ones. And two final ones I'd like to mention that are worth checking out, a couple of documentaries. Similar in one way, in that they both focus on perfectionism and dedicating your life to a craft and the sacrifices that causes you to make. Those are Indie Game the Movie. I know, which hasn't been to everyone's taste who's been interested in video games, but I found it really quite interesting. And the other being Chihiro Dreams of Sushi, which is eye-opening in one way, that somebody could dedicate so much of their life to, well, cutting up fish, really. It's nothing but impressive, the dedication that these people go to be the very, very best at what they do. Again, it's cutting up some fish, so I'm not sure it's worthwhile, but he's made a good living out of it and he's very well respected, so perhaps he's right and I'm wrong.
I think the last two will put as part of this, and I think at points this is more because I'm the only defender of them in around these parts, is that I certainly don't buy the whole film of the year candidate that has been knocked about as, but I think Gravity is a good film, and I think you should certainly see it.
Gravity's good.
It is certainly by a long margin the least worst Sandra Bullock thing.
I actually did quite like her in The Blind Side, although I haven't watched that again recently. Her accent does get a bit grating and the film's a bit too schmaltzy, but Gravity's good. It's just not brilliant, and I never quite got the praise for it. It's an above average disaster movie. It's not the great second coming of, well, whatever people apply to that after that.
I mean, a lot of it, I kind of like what they were doing with like the physical effects work and that, but you know, it's nothing that we've not seen before in sort of slightly other incarnations in Batman, that kind of thing, or more appropriately, Inception, which is perhaps, I think, a better graphics tour de force, but regardless, I think Gravity's a good film.
Yeah, I think it's good, and there are some really outstanding moments in it. I mean, the two sort of big action sequences, granted, do look fantastic. The collisions with the space debris, and that unbroken, like, single-take, 30-minute opening is one of the best single scenes in cinema all year, but the rest of it just was okay at best for me. I think you may lose something seeing it on a smaller screen because of the idea of the scale of being in space, but given that they do tend to dispense with the scale of being in space for narrative convenience anyway, maybe it doesn't matter so much.
Another one, again, it doesn't belong in best films of the year list, but I think there's a kernel of something really interesting in Man of Steel that I think the film doesn't quite get to with a sort of the new Superman film. I think it's tonally, I think trying to move it towards a kind of dark, gritty Batman kind of aesthetic is probably not going to work for the character long run, but I think it does at least open up interesting opportunities to go with in future. You can certainly pick flaws with the film. I think there are some good performances in there. I just wish it featured more Superman in it rather than so many flashbacks and various other bits and bobs where I think the actual central character of Henry Cavill's Superman gets kind of underexposed. And what usually needs to be giving it a grounding for something interesting coming future. So it's kind of interesting watching on that basis.
I'm just a bit concerned though that they're going straight into Justice League next stuff with like Batman and Superman.
Yeah.
I think they could really have done with exploring the character Superman a bit more.
Yeah.
And find sort of an interesting hook in there, because I'm not by any means the first person to say that Superman is or potentially can be a pretty dull character. And it might be nice to explore his character a bit more before you just put him in a film with lots of other characters.
Yeah.
I think many of them weren't that great, but Marvel took their time and created a lot of separate films before going for the Avengers, and Warner Brothers seemed to go, no, me too. We're going to do it now. Look, we've done it. And I think we're pretty sure there's no one at the wheel at Warner Brothers anyway, Scott, aren't we? So.
Yeah.
It's not surprising, but it is disappointing.
So I think that might cover us for the films that we really, truly, properly enjoyed this year. As is traditional, we normally go on to something that is perhaps disappointments rather than your out-and-out worst films of the year. Do you have anything in that particular category that you would like to investigate?
A few films here. There's one that is bad, but mostly bothered me because it was a disappointment. In fact, two that were huge disappointments. One, which is really terrible, but it was a horror film, so I'd expect it to be. But the other film, that there was one film that I really hated, properly, outright despised this year, and it's the one I mentioned there that I seem to have put out of my head, and that's A Field in England. A Field in England is dire. There was so much hype around it. It was released in cinema, on Blu-ray, and on film, for television on the same day, and shit.
It really is.
It doesn't have a story. It doesn't have any interesting characters. Well, they're barely characters. The idea that possibly there are aspects of one person's psyche doesn't help. It doesn't make them any more interesting or compelling. It's only cost £200,000, but it still seems like somebody got ripped off somewhere. I don't understand the hype around it. I mean, and it's good that there was a film I produced in Britain that got so many people talking about film at the same time. It's just a pity that it was one that was so without any merit at all.
Yeah, it's the sort of film you might be forgiven for thinking it's hard to follow until you realise that nothing actually happens.
There isn't anything to follow is the issue here.
It just wasn't any good. There's just nothing there. No. There's literally nothing there. I mean, it's a good title. It does have a field in England, but that's all it has.
Yeah. most accurate film title of the year, certainly. It wins. It also, unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, wins worst film of the year. I mean, it's only a 90-minute film, but 90 minutes was a hell of a struggle, given it didn't have enough stuff to fill 9 minutes. Nothing happens! Yeah.
Tell you what, I'll give you a couple of disappointments, which you can weigh in on otherwise, before we get to something that was actually the worst. I mean, if we're going to talk about the film that I actually enjoyed the least, then it doesn't really count because it's a horror film, and it's Mama, because it just wasn't any good, and it wasn't scary, and it made this critical mistake of showing you the monster, which looked absolutely shit very early on, and then showing you it 17 times, at which point any hope of tension, which, to be honest, it could have had. There's moments in there that did seem kind of a little bit creepy towards the start, but as soon as you blowed its load so early and it was so amazingly poorly done, it really couldn't have gone any further. But as I say, that's just that's you would expect that to be the worst film because it's a horror film, and I have a very low reputation of horror films. I'm sure there were much worse horror films during the year which could easily have gone below that in this pecking order. I just happened to watch Mama because it was one that I thought could have elevated it because it had a decent cast. And
yeah, that's the horror film I was referencing earlier, Scott. It definitely was my least enjoyable film of the year. That, without doubt, was A Field in England, because Mama, it bored me. I expected to be bored. It was a horror film. I genuinely look forward to the time I properly enjoy a horror film and I'm scared. It never happens. Never, ever happens. And I would love it to, it just doesn't. But A Field in England, I genuinely hated watching, and it was a real struggle to get to the end of it. But whereas Mama's, like, I was bored. I expected to be bored so I could sort of phase that out a bit. But it is a terrible film. I was sort of intrigued, and Jessica Chastain looks like she's going to be quite interesting. She's not been in all that much of late, but been in a few interesting things. She's in The Help. She quite quickly stepped up to a larger role in The Debt, and then Zero Dark Thirty. She's quite interesting. I like your fella from Game of Thrones, Nikolai Coster-Waldau.
Yeah.
And it's, while I don't like all of his films, it was produced by Guillermo del Toro, and I kind of thought that in this case that meant more than produced or presented by Quentin Tarantino often means.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It means exactly the same, which is bugger all, really.
Yeah, so there's a couple of... Well, the good thing about Mama is it presents a couple of links in the two films I want to talk about. But first, I think first, in terms of disappointments, you mentioned Jessica Chastain. Zero Dark Thirty really isn't any good. And I don't understand why people think that it is. It just seemed awfully dull. It's a reasonable procedural, but it's just a bit dull.
Yeah.
And I can understand the motive nature of what they're actually procedurally trying to do, you know, capture Osama bin Laden. But it's dull. As you would expect, it's a lot of work of surveillance and spreadsheets and analysing accounts and all this sort of thing. But I get in general why it's interesting to make a film about this kind of thing, but it's not a very interesting film.
Again, we've got procedural stuff. You look at some of the films we've talked about this year, like Lincoln. That's procedural stuff, manages to make it fascinating. Stuff like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which is really slow burning, and some of it perhaps more in the television series than the film, but it's about just sort of tradecraft and stuff. And it can be quite slow, but it's still really compelling. And Zero Dark Thirty is just boring.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad film in a number of sense, but just given the amount of hype around it that was built up, and it just didn't quite deliver on it. Perhaps the other thing in this category that is, you know, not actually a bad film as such, but I had hoped for much more, would be Stoker. It is one of the few films where I've actually fallen asleep watching it, but Chan-Wook Park, for me, is one of my... A director I'm just supremely interested in most of his work. He's done so many good things throughout the years that even his early stuff, I mean, you know, Joint Security Era, it might not be the best film in absolute terms, but it's still quite interesting. Yeah. And when you go from that into things like Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance and that trilogy and Old Boy, you know, and what a career he could stop now, and he'd still be one of the best directors he's ever filmed. Stoker seemed like it could be interesting. It's got a decent cast. But at the end of the day, it just seemed awfully boring and not an awful lot happens in it.
Yeah, Stoker's certainly my worst of the year list. There are some very effective scenes in it. There's some quite erotic and uncomfortably erotic scenes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Matthew Good does do a good job of looking super creepy. And it looks lovely. It's beautifully shot, beautifully composed. It's very, very deliberate. Again, nothing happens.
It is glacially based.
It's absolutely glacially based. Mia Wasikowska, again, those scenes which seem like without doing much, quite powerfully erotic, and again, it really is uncomfortable if you see the context of them. But she's so withdrawn. It's the way her character's written. The character's so withdrawn that they've taken her from being sort of introverted to being blank. And it's a big issue. It also has issues with being, well, plot-wise, daft. Some of the plot points, particularly towards the end of the film, simply don't make any sense. And as good as it looks, you can't rely on that for the whole running time. And sort of the final main issue I have with it is that, bar a couple of minor characters that are there for maybe 5 or 6 minutes each, the whole film hinges on three characters, and one of them, Nicole Kidman, may as well not be there.
Yeah.
It's a real disappointment. Again, as Scott's saying, with the director's pedigree, even though things like Thirst of late haven't been exactly setting the world on fire, you'd hope for a lot more, and it's quite interesting who the film writer was, but the things surrounding the film are far more interesting than the film itself.
Yeah.
Which is a problem. If we're on the theme of disappointments, etc., Scott, one film which sort of disappointed me in the middle of it by getting my hopes up for the first 20 minutes being really rather funny, and then the next 60 minutes being some of the worst of the year, and that's Machete Kills.
Yeah.
I went into it knowing it'd be silly, knowing it'd be stupid, knowing it'd be over the top. I didn't know it'd stop after 20 minutes and run out of all ideas beyond that point. It was a thin premise to begin with. It was based on a fake trailer. First film was fun. First 20 minutes that was so fun. Really hope they stop now. I assume they will. I don't think it was very popular, but they have, of course, left the film in a place where they could have Machete Kills in space as a third film. I just hope they don't. Please, Mr. Rodriguez, stop now.
My other combo of director who I respect and absolutely shitballs film would be Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim's just rotten. I just do not understand what is going on in this film at all. Normally sane people seem to like it. Again, it's in the disappointments category because those trailers looked awesome because you've got massive robots fighting massive space monsters. What more could you want? Well, you would have wanted some semblance of a plot or something that made any sort of sense. Dialogue that wasn't written by a 12-year-old. Characters that were at least one-dimensional, let alone no-dimensional, which they are here. There's just so many things wrong with this film that it's difficult to know where to begin. At the central tale of it, I could let it away with being an absolute cheeseball in a number of categories if it was any fun, but it isn't. It's just, again, CG chunks knocking hell out of other CG chunks, but done very boringly with really dreadful dialogue and just lots of things it makes no sense whatsoever.
And you think
the whole central premise for the whole conflict makes no sense at all. None of it makes any good of all.
You're getting quite exercised about that, and just two nights ago you thought you still liked it more than Craig did, so Craig might really get torn into that.
It's just a waste of talent and effort and money, and I just don't see what anyone could think of is fun in the film. And it puzzles me because I know a lot of people do think that it's fun, and it plainly is not. Yeah, Pacific Rim is definitely on my avoid list.
Another one for me, it's absolutely one of my least enjoyable films of the year, but what bothers me more is simply the soul-crushing disappointment of the work of the director and star being something I've particularly liked, and indeed together. It was one of my favourite films of last year, the year before. You know, I'm going to talk about Scott's Only God Forgives.
Yep.
Nicholas Winding Refn. I must make sure to find out how exactly you pronounce that name. I'll work on that. And Ryan Gosling. One of actually three very disappointing Ryan Gosling films this year, which is, well, very disappointing. It's in The Place Beyond the Pines was, well, not very good, really, but he was scintillating in the first portion of it, and had it been a short, would have been a great film, in fact.
Yeah.
Gangster Squad was something he was in for a paycheck, I guess. It was the Untouchables as done by a 12-year-old, and about as good as that sounds, just with a strange thing that attracted quite an astonishing cast.
Yeah.
Ryan Gosling, Sean Penn, Josh Brolin, I don't know how that pulled that off. Nick Nolte as well. Not that there's any point putting it out in any films nowadays, because you can never understand a word he says. But Only God Forgives was the real stinker. Coming after Drive, same director, star, looking at the trailers, thinking, oh, this looks quite stylish. And really, you get the film, nothing happens. Ryan Gosling's clearly only there for his name, because he doesn't have a character. He's just a person who's there to do things. There's not much of a plot. It's stylistically ugly and oppressive. Oh, such a disappointing film. It's a film where, strange to point too, that the only person you can really identify with in the film is a sociopathic cop who chops people's arms off instead of taking them to court. He's the best character in it. It's ugly, tedious, pointless, impossible to care about anybody in, and I'm so disappointed to be looking so forward to it so much after Drive.
Yeah, this is my worst film of the year for roughly the same reasons. Look forward to it an awful lot, given its pedigree and its actors, and it is just boring. It's relentlessly boring. I mean, it manages to make extreme acts of violence look boring.
Yeah. It's like, oh, he's chopped his arms off. That's rather tawdry, really.
It should at least have been disgusting or shocking in those moments, and somehow it's managed to make all of that boring. It's heartening to see this appear on just as many worst films of the year as best films of the year lists, but when it comes to the people that are putting on the best films of the year list, I really just can't see what they're getting behind. I don't see what redeems this film in any way. A lot of people are talking about the cinematography and things like that, but there's not really any art to it. It's just red. That's all they've done. Is they made the first half hour red, and that seems to fool people into thinking, oh, this is a masterwork of reinterpreted lighting, and it's not. It's just red.
Deeply oppressive and unpleasant. And do you know, if I really wanted to see a film as a shot in red, I'd watch a submarine film. I watched The Hunt for Red October or something. It'd be better.
I agree with all that in terms of characterization. There's not any. The action's not particularly exciting. It's just boring all the way throughout. And it's the same sort of reason as behind A Field in England. It is just absolutely dull. And even though more happens in this, it's of equally little consequence.
And for a lot more money.
Yeah, it's just not any good. I don't see any redeeming features in it at all.
No, nor do I.
Gosling and everyone looks bored. It's a waste of all these actors and actresses. Kirsten Thomas and all that just look awfully bored and miscast in a lot of places. It's just not interesting. There's nothing in it.
No.
I really genuinely did not enjoy this in the slightest, and I don't see what there is in there that anyone else would enjoy. I just cannot comprehend it.
Comprehend people like it. I'd maybe accept that they like the styling of it more than I did. I don't see why, because it really is very, very ugly and oppressive. I keep coming back to that word, but that's what it felt like during it. And, well, maybe you'd accept that as deliberate. Okay, I didn't enjoy it, but perhaps that's deliberate. But that's about the only thing I think you could reasonably have a disagreement on, because there isn't much of a story. There are no characters, really, and particularly Ryan Gosling, he doesn't have a character.
Yeah.
He's just there to wear some clothes. And I can't understand what you could possibly think he's doing other than wearing some clothes. He doesn't have any interesting dialogue. It's horrendously misogynistic, but doesn't seem to be saying that's a bad thing or anything. You just be cruel to him and he kill a lot of people and the film ends. Great.
I'm just looking through the trivia on IMDb, and if I'd known that before going into it that Nicholas Winding Refn had said that Gaspar Noé's work was an inspiration during the making of this movie, I genuinely wouldn't have bothered to see this at all. You can see the direct influence, because both are shit. it has all of the worst elements of Gaspar Noé's work, but somehow without any of the shock value that might be attached to some of Gaspar Noé's stuff. I can actually now see that it's trying to plough the same path, but managing somehow, miraculously, to get even worse returns than Gaspar Noé's work does. So if you liked shitbox films like Irreversible and Enter the Void, which were two of my least favourite films of those respective years, then I'm sure you'll get a lot of joy out of Only God Forgives, and also please stop listening. You are not the sort of person who wish to attract around these parts, thank you.
You're disqualified. You have forfeited the right to our awesome opinions. One other real disappointment I want to talk about. This one's cheating slightly because it was a 2012 film, but it's one that we didn't catch up with until this year and we covered this year. It falls into the same sort of category as Only God Forgives, in that both the stars and the director gave me a huge amount of confidence that it would be really good. I was very, very much looking forward to it, and it was also shitballs. And that's the master. Not quite as egregious as Only God Forgives, but for a film with Philip Seymour Hoffman and it directed by P.T. Anderson, it was just deeply, deeply disappointing. Very dull, not a lot happens, didn't really seem to have a lot to say. Full of unlikable characters that you can't engage with in any way, shape or form. The Master, it was rubbish. There's my eloquent dismissal of The Master. There's not much more to say, I simply really, really did not enjoy it at all.
Great director and great acting and talent that you'd expect a lot more for, and it just turned out to be very dull.
Right then, that rather lengthy list of what floated our boat or got their goat in 2013 over. Normal service will resume shortly. Thank you for staying with us. If you have any feedback on that, you'd like to comment on it or talk to us about it, you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com or tweet us at @theoneliner on Twitter. Obviously, that tends to be where you tweet. Aye. Anyway, so that's us for now. and we'll be back with our regularly scheduled programming in a week or so, or longer, because we're really, really reliable like that. I was Drew. Scott assures me he was Scott.
Ta-ta.
Bye-bye.
I like the easy questions from The Guardian. Is Gary Barlow a national treasure?
No.
Next, please.